Now on to our roundtable. Joining us today from our NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C., Mary Frances Berry. She's a professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania. From our Chicago bureau, Roland Martin, executive editor of the Chicago Defender, and Jeff Obafemi-Carr, host of the radio program Freestyle, joins us from Nashville, Tennessee, at Spotland Productions there. I thank you all. Greatly appreciate it. Mary, when you look at the numbers, talk to me about what you think this rally did yesterday.
Well, I think what it did not do was shut down the country economically. That was one thing it didn't do. One thing it did do was to show the solidarity among the people who are arguing for fair immigration reform, and that they were out there in huge numbers, and it showed somewhat also the places where they are and that they are determined to fight. I think that on immigration, though, on the one hand, you can be for it, for the people who are protesting because they're protesting, and that's the American way, and that it's moral and that it's humane and principled to let them in. But you can also lament some of the rhetoric that is there that I think ought to be changed. All this business about jobs that Americans won't do. Anybody who reads and pays attention knows that a majority of the kinds of jobs they're talking about are done by people who are legal all across the country, and a minority, and in some places are, so they don't need to say that. I think that the appeal to morality, the appeal to bring me your tired, your huddled masses to opportunity was embodied in what happened yesterday, and I think it was very powerful and it was very effective.
Here's what's interesting to me, Roland Martin. I heard a friend of mine say that what he believed he saw yesterday was the rising of white man's fears, personified perhaps, if you agree with that, with Lou Dobbs of CNN, suggesting that illegal immigration is depressing middle class wages, that we are seeing this group now being taken on by the radical left, et cetera, making a stance to say enough is enough, we're not going to have this.
Well, I think the big issue here is, how do you reconcile the illegal part of illegal immigrants? And so when you have individuals making an argument that make us U.S. citizens when they came into the country illegally, I think that's where you have this disconnect. And it's not just with white males. I mean, I'll tell you point blank, you know, look, I got a talk show on an all-black radio station, and, man, black folks are, I mean, it's probably running 8 out of 10 against granting these rights. And so you have a lot of people who are tied up emotionally. And frankly, I think Congress is really in a quagmire, because if you go left, if you go right, you're going to face a lot of heat.
Here, Jeff, is what I also heard in the discussion I had with a group of people yesterday, that there was some envy, if you will, with this group being able to show this kind of solidarity. One of our producers even suggested that perhaps we should see African Americans out in the streets rallying and protesting the idea of 50% black male unemployment and some of the ills that still face us, that perhaps we're not stepping up and should take a lesson here.
Well, I definitely would agree that there is a spirit of activism that is missing from the African American community that we're seeing here on the part of the Hispanic community, and they're speaking their minds. They're actually coming together in a way that we haven't come together in 30 years plus. I think it was a great move or a great idea for them to borrow from the Doug Turner Ward play Day of Absence, where black people disappeared for a day, to start as a notion, to seem to get inspiration from that piece, and then to move it into a huge series of rallies is definitely something that's very important. I think it is a model, because I think African Americans have become quite docile in the way that they deal with the issues, that we deal with our issues. Now, whether a mass protest is going to solve something for us or not, I'm not quite sure if there's not a program behind it. But I do think that the spirit of activism is important. And I think that it's needed in this day and age to combat the same kind of stereotypes that we face, that we see the mm-hmm. Latinos fighting against.
But Ed, I've got to jump in here and say this. Ed, I think it's really, really important. The difference is, when you look at the issue facing African Americans in the Civil Rights Movement, there was one unifying issue that touched every African-American, regardless of class, regardless of education. I think that's the same thing you have here. When you begin to identify concerns today specific to African-Americans, you don't have an issue such as inner-city unemployment among black men that resonates across education, across class. And so I think it's apples and oranges trying to compare the two. African-Americans have stood up. You've seen Million Man March. You've seen millions more movement. But I think this is a different issue. Now the issue for them, though, is how do you translate marches into political progress? That's now going to be the hard part, and that's often the overlooked part when it comes to African-Americans during the Civil Rights Movement.
Well, I'd agree with you on the Million Man March. I don't know that I would agree with you on the Millions More Movement what we saw there. Mary, you wanted to say?
Oh, well, the Millions More Movement and the Millions Man March, we had all those people, but Farrakhan said, and I pointed this out to him, you were coming to march on Washington, but you didn't ask Washington for anything. Mm-hmm. Pointedly, these folks are asking for policy changes. We haven't had African Americans marching in those numbers asking for policy changes. However, the Latinos marching with other immigrant groups in smaller numbers is a new story. Their power, their coming to power, their numbers, mm-hmm. the burgeoning of it. The African Americans marching is not a new story. So I don't know, it'd have to be formulated in a way. And we are in a post-civil rights generation, my students keep reminding me. And it is hard because of fracturing of classes and the masses mm-hmm. and the middle class and all the rest to come around together around an issue. It's something
But Mary, here's the $64,000 question. Is this one of those seismic shifts that we're starting to see in terms of political might possibly from African Americans who have run a strong second for a mighty long time?
Is it a change in political might? Yes. It perhaps is a seismic change. It depends on what happens on the policy side. If what happens is a real crackdown on immigration, a real crackdown, and the numbers don't come to power as the Latinos are saying, then we've got a different can of worms. But if, in fact, the immigration reform is mild and you get legalization and you get people voting and the power is expressed, African Americans will be in second or third place.
The
jealousy is a good thing. All right.
No, I think the jealousy is a good thing. If we see somebody doing something and we decide that we're going to have to get up and do it, I think that's good.
Yeah. Right. All right. Let me turn our attention to something that made news over the weekend, and we want to make sure that we talk about this because it's very, very interesting. And I think it's also interesting to note that we have seen Colin Powell do this before, overseas, make these statements in a private British television station interview. Colin Powell suggested over the weekend that he had told Tommy Franks, Donald Rumsfeld, and the president that he felt that they did not have enough troops in the region. He went on to say, I don't think we had enough force there to impose order. The aftermath turned out to be much more difficult than anyone had anticipated. Roland Martin, when we see this, what does this say about a man who really personifies in most people's minds the good soldier?
Colin Powell is a modern-day Henry Kissinger when he is trying to protect his public relations interest. Let's just cut to the chase. I mean, I like Colin Powell. He's a great guy, but he's very good at protecting his name. And the reality is he will not say these things to the New York Times or to the Washington Post or to the L.A. Times or to an American network. He will not be this honest and forthright.
But he's smart enough to know it's going to get out, Roland. He's smart enough to know that it will be reported on this side of the ocean. It's not like he believes it won't be said here.
But
it's
different
than what celebrities do. Celebrities will give a story to London, and then we'll pick it up.
Roland, you didn't really get to the chase. The chase really is that if Colin Powell had said any of this and then said, I'm going to resign as Secretary of State while he was there, it would have changed the policy and had an impact, and lots of lives perhaps might have been saved.
Do you believe that, Mary? Do you believe that he resigned, it would have changed policy?
Perhaps if he had said, I was wrong when I made that talk at the UN about WMD, and I also told them we needed more troops and they didn't send them there, I think the American people would have gotten together and had consensus earlier if Powell, the good guy, the good soldier. And one other point about this. When Connie Rice said that Mr. Bush listened to his military advisors, here is a man who was a general, who was in charge of most of what happened in the first war that his father had in Iraq, who's sitting there when the war is about to start and advises him that he needs more troops. And he's going to listen to other commanders, military commanders, who, when this guy had been chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and not listen to him. And then it's characterized as, well, he listened to his military commanders on this. So I think Powell is either chicken or he is crass for coming out and saying all these little things in dribs and drabs after so many lives have been lost and so many injured that I get letters from all the time and go visit and all the rest and the wounded and the amputees and all the rest of them. Just breaks your heart for him to do this. And yet for everyone to keep saying, well, I like Colin Powell, but...
Here's what I found interesting, Jeff, if you'll pick up on this for me, please. Uh-huh. Pick up on your point. But the idea that when they addressed this issue to Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, she said that she did not remember specifically what instance Powell was referring to.
How many times have we heard this one? Well, we have a couple of things operating here. I'm not surprised at all that Condoleezza is defending President Bush to the bitter end at every corner, at every stop, right or wrong. She preserves that president's image in every minuscule number of people's minds as a leader who relied on what he believed was solid advice from his advisors to even get into this in the first place. And it keeps him it keeps him separated in a sense, and it keeps him protected. This is a formula script that we view weekly on the continuing drama Bush and Company. Condoleezza is going to do whatever's right to keep her role in this show. Colin Powell, however, began to stray a little bit from the script when loyalty began to lead him into a minefield that was the Bush foreign military policy, to the point where he just couldn't really totally be complicit in something that would sacrifice human lives. And the administration doesn't accept that. They want their team to walk blindly into the minefield, even when there's a cat with a conscience on the sideline with a metal detector saying, I don't think we should step over here. So I agree that Colin Powell could have resigned. It would have made a statement. But I think Colin's loyalty was just to not take it into another realm by being involved in it any further when he left office.
Yeah, I mean,
Roland
Martin, let's pick up on that point and be honest about it. We all knew at the time of the debate that Colin Powell was the lone wolf out there and had been fighting that battle behind closed doors to say, A, if you break it, you got to buy it. We shouldn't be in there. We should look at different diplomacy in the Middle East. He had been banging down those doors.
Well, when you reach a point when you cannot get someone's attention, when you strongly believe that this is how we should be going, I think, as Mary suggested, when you step up and do that, trust me, if the Secretary of State, if the man who was chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, U.S. Strategic Air Command, major military experience, if he stood up and said, this is not right, it is not proper, we should not be going to war, this intelligence is weak, and then we're committing not enough troops, trust me, it would have completely changed the course of this debate. And I don't necessarily think we would be in the position that we're in now. I simply don't believe it because he had that much credibility. He's lost a significant portion of his credibility by carrying the president's water and now all of a sudden saying, well,
maybe I'm the
lone
wolf here. I don't believe that. I don't believe if he had resigned at that point that it would have changed the policy. I don't believe that Bush would have said, oh, my God, we're losing Colin Powell. Let's stop down. I think they would have said that he was the lone wolf. They would have marked Rumsfeld out.
But it would have changed. I'm not talking about Bush.
No. They would have. But that's who ultimately you have to.
But Bush is the decision maker, not public policy.
But now we'll never know. But now we'll never know, will we? Because he didn't step up to the plate and did it.
It's a matter of principle. But if was a fifth, we'd all be extremely drunk right now. We could talk about if, but the bottom line is if Colin would have strayed, he would have been exorcised, he would have been demonized, he would have been seen as somebody who was, he would have been tossed on the side with a public relations campaign, and it wouldn't have done anything. Bush doesn't care about what public opinion is.
He would have been demonized by the right, but the general public, it's a different matter because, again, when you look at a person's credibility and their integrity and how the public responds, that is a different kind of person than Cindy Sheehan after the fact saying we shouldn't be there.
And while that is true, if policy would have changed.
Now,
and I doubt
impact,
very seriously.
What impact will it have now? That's the question. I mean,
well,
we
that's
can
true,
do the
Mary. If we had another minute, we could get into it.
It'll give Colin a new book to write, man.
Mary Frances Berry, Roland Martin, and Jeff O'Boffenby Carr, thank you so much. Greatly appreciate it.
Thanks, Ed.
Just a note to the listeners, if you'd like to comment on any topic you've heard here on the Roundtable or any of the stories we report here on News and Notes, you can do so by calling us at 202-408-3330. That's 202-408-3330. Or you can send us an email. Log on to NPR.org and click on Contact Us. Please be sure to tell us where you're writing from and how to pronounce your name. And as many of you know, every Thursday we air some of those comments.